Okay. While we're loading up here, I guess you're going to see my full disclosure. All that will zip right through the disclosure. And there we go. Just to wrap up on the panel, let me just say I'm very honored to be here to join the panel with Kay, Paul, and Jean to talk a little bit, as you can see from my title, to talk a little bit about a state's perspective. Speaking of states, it is an honor also not only to be on this panel, but to be here in North Carolina. So for those of you that are North Carolinians or Charlotte, I don't say Charlotte. What do you say, Charlotte? Charlatanians? Charlatines? Or
not Charlatans.
No, we know that. But for those of you that are local, you should know that for those of us in Maryland, we have watched you. We have emulated what you've done in public health here in North Carolina because you were really the state to beat. And so I say that very genuinely because of all the achievements, certainly, that Dr. Gerald talked about. That you all have done in North Carolina. I thought it was with nothing, it turns out, it turns out it is actually with nothing. So congratulations to you all, a lot in North Carolina. Also listening to Jean, it's that accent. Isn't that kind of sweet, you know, for those of us Northerners? It's not Mississippi, I know that, but that accent.
It's nice to be here. The people don't have any accent.
No, I think they have very pronounced accents. Wouldn't you say so? So for those of us up from the North that flew in this morning, it's great to be here. Let me just say, in terms of disclosure, yes, I'm going to share with you a little bit about, from a state's perspective, my state, Maryland, what we've been doing with a whole lot less and with a whole lot of energy and things that I am just so excited about in public health that we're doing. But I'm going to give you some full disclosure. I come to the state job for almost 4 years, and before that, I was a local health officer for 15 years in a county in Maryland. And so having the chance to have worked with communities, with our schools, with our police departments, with our with all of the community organizations and faith-based communities that those of you in local health are doing now. That's such a gift. And so I can sincerely say from a state's perspective, what is so happening locally now is truly phenomenal, and that's really where people's lives change and where health happens. So with that little bit of caveat, the other thing I want to say is that the things that I'm going to talk about now are truly, I think, hopeful. I think they're really exciting. I don't want to be a Pollyanna. I don't want to fool you. I don't want you to think that we haven't had a recession in Maryland. We've had a horrible time for the last 5 years. So our public health budgets, state and local, have been decimated. Millions of dollars have been wiped out of the system. Hundreds of jobs are gone. Hundreds and hundreds of jobs across the state are gone. In fact, I've been there almost 4 years. I was hired by the same governor we have now. We've had an election, and Governor O'Malley was rehired for a second term, fortunately. Now, when I came, there was a secretary, a state health secretary, who was my boss, and in Maryland has one of those mega agencies for health. So it's public health, it's Medicaid, and it's behavioral health. The health secretary who was there for O'Malley's first term was pretty burned out because he went through year after year, budget cycle of really gut-wrenching cuts. And so when Governor O'Malley was reelected, I'm told, because I wasn't there, that he brought his cabinet together and he said, we're going to do great things in our second term, but this has been really hard. So for those of you that think you don't want to stick around for a second term, now's a good time to let me know. So what happened in that transition is that a new secretary came into Maryland, our secretary now, Secretary Sharfstein, who came to Maryland almost 2 years ago from having been the deputy at the FDA. And I'm giving you all this context because I think it's important that you see where all this hope is coming from. It's not coming from the budget. It's coming from leadership that has truly, truly innovative and cutting-edge ideas about what can happen in public health, what's the potential of public health. And so Secretary Sharfstein came from the FDA. The reason he took that job with Governor O'Malley is because in our state, we are a totally full blue state in terms of full-on implementation of the ACA. So our secretary came in order to get in front of the Affordable Care Act and put it forth for the people of Maryland. Now, what he came with also was tremendous public health experience and background, having formerly been the commissioner of public health commissioner in the city of Baltimore. So here I am, the deputy secretary for public health. Here comes a new secretary who knows everything about public health, knows everything about the federal government. And what we did was strap on the seatbelts, because there have been some amazing changes in Maryland that I want to walk you through real quickly that have nothing to do with the budget. So I don't want to discount how terribly difficult this has been, not only for Maryland State Health Department, but for our local health departments, but to show you some things that really are possible even in that environment. So now in Maryland, we've got the lowest infant mortality rate that we have ever had in the state. We have the lowest smoking rate. I won't compare other states, but in terms of our kids that are smoking, lower than ever. Our cancer rate is down. The health disparity gap on colon cancer has shrunk to the lowest in the country. We've made some phenomenal gains. Not to say that we have a lot more room for improvement. We do. But we've got some things that we can really be proud of. So what I want to share with you real quickly are three areas that I think bear some consideration in you and for you and your settings with regard to how you really can do some more with less. Building collaborative relationships. And certainly you heard about that from the other speakers. You heard about that from Dr. Berwick. The idea is how to leverage the organizations that you already work with, how to find the win-win, the mutual agendas, and really get embedded in those kinds of organizations, that kind of momentum that's happening anyway, and embed public health goals in that environment. Second area is leveraging financial incentives. I'm going to show you some financial incentives that we have in Maryland. I bet you have them in your state. And these are incentives that will improve health delivery and do so to reduce costs and will continue regardless of what happens by the Supremes on Thursday. So these are incentives that are built into the system now because of the payers, because of the way our system is, and public payers and private payers are looking at alternative delivery models, and there's tremendous opportunity. There's a space for public health in those financing reforms. And then lastly, technology. This is huge. There are some things that, Secretary Sharfstein tweets on a regular basis. He's tweeting right now, I'm sure. There are opportunities for technology to advance public health in ways that we haven't even imagined. So let me go through those real quickly, those three areas. The first is to talk a little bit about collaborative relationships. You have heard, and many of you are working on state or local health improvement plans, coalitions, with community partners. I have to tell you, 18 months ago, Maryland didn't have a state health improvement plan. We were at zero. We were absolutely at zero, and we have catapulted now to a process. We don't call it a plan. We call it the state health improvement process, or the SHIP. The SHIP has been launched. And what it launched was a framework. It was a framework for local health departments, local coalitions to work. 18 months ago, we had more goals, more targets. It could have been Healthy People 2020. It was hundreds of things across every unit of our health department that different programs were struggling to achieve. Through a consensus process, largely using existing coalitions and the websites, we garnered public comment on what are the leading indicators, what are the leading priorities for Maryland. And we set a limit, 40. We came in with 39. The idea was, let's marshal what we do around a small number of goals. And for each one of those goals, here's the rigor, that discipline. For each one of those goals, there needs to be data. It needs to be hard and consistent data. And it needs to be data that is available locally. So it's not good enough to talk about BRFS data at a state level on the prevalence of diet, for example, of fresh fruits and vegetables. Unless we can break that down locally where the health improvement action happens, we couldn't use that indicator. So through a consensus process, we've got 39 indicators for the state. No one size fits all. So now, as a result of this launching of the SHIP, there are now 17 coalitions around the state who are looking through those 39 indicators to find the ones that are the most meaningful for their local jurisdictions and marching ahead with that. So here's currently what these 17 coalitions in Maryland are working on. This is probably a familiar list to you. These are their top three priorities for the next 2 years. Oh, the other thing about the state health improvement process, this isn't a kind of a manana exercise. This is very short term. What are the goals for 2014. So the idea is, let's get progress that's short-term and let's measure it. So this is the examples of what the coalitions right now are working on. Who's on the coalitions? Coalitions are the usual suspects. Certainly the hospitals, the health department, the community college, the board of education, the employers, the faith-based communities, the social organizations. What we did at the state is we said, by default, the local health officer is the chair of the coalition, unless there's some other arrangement. So the idea is the state would support local coalitions with data, would support local coalitions with a convening website, a collaborative, and also would support the role of the local health officer to take the lead. A couple of counties have said the local health officer stepped down and it's been the hospital CEO that's taken on the lead, but that was at the local health officer's discretion. The money for these, we had none. That was absolutely no money. We had no money to do this at all. And then what we found was the mutual understanding, the mutual identification by the hospitals largely that, hey, this is a good thing. This is in our best interest. We need to have this local coalition to get right with the ACA, to get right with community benefits requirements in the ACA, to do that community needs assessment. And so we leveraged from the State Hospital Association about $500,000 for those areas of the state that already didn't have an up and running coalition. That's startup money. $500,000 is seed money. We then found other places in the state budget, not in the state health department, but other commissions that looked at this coalition and thought, that's something good for us. So that leveraged another $600,000 to these 17 coalitions. Since then, they have been hugely aggressive in going out and applying successfully for private foundation and grant funding. We put a little wrinkle in this coalition business. When the state health department has grants to local health departments, pitifully, we don't have as many as we do, and we certainly don't have enough. We used to do everything straight by the book, straight by a formula, population, here's what it is. No. We're starting to look at what are the coalition's capacities, and so asking that a grant proposal that comes to the state, for example, for community transformation, which we have the good fortune of being able to administer, those come through the coalitions, that the coalition sign off on the proposal and the coalition takes responsibility for the outcome. Again, strengthening those coalitions in ways that have leveraged additional. I can't say enough about the community benefits requirements of hospitals. They know about it. They're starting to pay attention. It's not just about booking charity care. It's not just about putting on a health fair because on arthritis because somebody on the hospital board has a passion for arthritis. That's all well and good, but it needs to be aligned with what the community says the health priorities are. So here's a map. We've got a website. Everything I tell you is on a website. It's the same website. I won't repeat the URL, but the website is a very active collaborative for these coalitions. That's Maryland's counties. Every one of those counties in yellow has their own coalition. They decided, oh, no, we're going to do it ourselves. On the eastern shore of Maryland, which is probably where all the chicken that you ever eat is grown, it's a very rural area, they decided to gather together in two regional coalitions. But whether they're independent or whether they're regional, what they do now is they upload onto this state website all of their meeting materials, their coalition priorities, all of their links, amazing amount of resource and exchange that's going on, as well as the data on this website. Okay, so the next area that I want to talk a little bit about, and coalitions, I don't have coalitions with FQHCs to talk about in Maryland, and that's too bad. We're not a state that has a collaboration between FQHCs and public health right now. And I really want to spend some time on the next couple days talking to you in states that have a strong collaboration, because we don't have it, and we want to get there. All right, second area that I want to talk about is this business about financial incentives. Maryland is a little different because we got a waiver from the federal government on how we manage hospital bills with regard to Medicare. But regardless of our uniqueness, there are pressures now on hospitals not to readmit a patient for the same or even for an unrelated diagnosis within 30 days. Hospitals don't want to do that. You know, in the old days, it was a head in the bed. That made a hospital administrator happy if the census was 100% they were doing their job. Now it's just the opposite. Avoidable admissions to the emergency department, don't let it happen. Readmissions, don't let it happen. The financing is changing. And so what that means is the hospitals are starting to realize, we got to figure out who's out there in the community. Who can we do a warm handoff for a chronic disease, for a lady with congestive heart failure, no transportation, no family? We need to make sure that she gets her meds, she gets her next appointment, she's stable, and she doesn't come back. So it's in their own self-interest now to turn to us in the local health departments and to begin to forge those coalitions. Not just a coalition, no, that's too soft, a contract. And yeah, we need lawyers. We need the lawyers to help us develop these new relationships because they're coming at us. They're coming at us. Hospitals are coming at us. Nursing homes and chronic hospitals are coming at us to develop partnerships. Likewise, for patient-centered medical homes, I won't talk a lot about that, but many of you know that this is a new model. It's an old model, but it's a new model for primary care, not only to have the physician there, but to have a whole care team around that physician to make sure that in an ambulatory setting, people with complicated disease, complicated lives, get the support that they need to deliver more effective primary care. Again, there's a tremendous opportunity for public health, those public health departments with patient navigators, with community health workers, people who can get out of the office and make that enabling transfer so that the patient actually can come in and get to the appointment. So patient-centered medical home, huge opportunity for public health. Let me talk a minute about high-cost user case management. I think just about every state has a high-cost user health plan. This is for individuals who are now currently, until the ACA kicks in 2014, who are currently squeezed out of the private insurance market because they have a pre-existing condition. So they have a history of cancer, they have some disability, children with crippling diseases, errors of metabolism, people who are really sick, that gets them into this plan in the individual market. We have such a plan in Maryland. There's about 20,000 people in it. As I said, the definition to get into this plan is you have to be sick. Well, these people are extremely costly, as you can imagine, because some of them have catastrophic disease. They need organ transplants. They need every kind of high-tech offering that Hopkins and University of Maryland can offer them. But that's not all of them. If you look at the data on these 20,000 people, you'll find some people with congestive heart disease or diabetes who happen to rely on their local fire department, 911, when they feel like having a social call. So we have found that there are individuals who will call or their family member will call to be transported to a Baltimore City hospital, and in so doing, they will get that interaction. They'll get a warm meal. They'll get somebody to take care of them. Maybe they can get a shower. They can get cleaned up. And so you see this cycle on who pays for that emergency room. The high-cost user plan, which is a public plan. Who pays for the 911 call? Baltimore City does, the fire department. So looking at how to identify those calm hotspotters, those high use users, and have the Baltimore City Health Department, or for those that don't live in the city, the metropolitan, a county health department, apply high touch, low technology home visiting to keep her at home, to keep her company, to get her what she needs in terms of a hot meal, enormous cost savings. So that's a pilot that's going on right now. And again, it's an opportunity for health departments to do creative partnering. The last thing to talk about, it was mentioned earlier, employee wellness. There are employers who are literally coming out of the woodwork to us in Maryland trying to figure out how they can drive down their health benefits. Some of them are taking shortcuts. Some of them are taking shortcuts like these high deductible plans. Okay, high deductible plan, low premium, but the first $4,000 is on you. So we're seeing in some of our local health departments, kids are coming into us, quote, insured kids, but they're coming into us to get immunizations because they're in these high deductible plans. We're working with employers on an alternative to that. The alternative is looking at, depending on what their budget is, and some employers have zero budget, but looking at evidence-based wellness programs for their employees that work. And so one of the things that we've done on another website, but we convene, we now have over 160 employers, large, medium, and small, representing about 250,000 Maryland employees, plus their families, on a web-based collaborative on what we can do, what employers can do to improve the bottom line, the return on investment that they make, and we want to encourage them to continue to make for their employees' health. So the opportunity to partner with employers is a huge place, a huge win-win for public health. So let me lastly get to the last area, which is the technology piece that is just so exciting because it really does push the edges of innovation. Like most states, Maryland has got a pretty robust health information exchange now. All of our 46 acute hospitals have signed on. They're sending data from their emergency rooms, from radiology, and from lab. So we've got all of that flowing on this information exchange. Yeah, we've got a policy board, and I'm on it, along with a lot of other people who are looking for to make sure that there are consumer safeguards, that there's privacy. But this is an enormous boon for the clinical treatment of patients who show up in an emergency room. You don't know what meds they're on. You don't know what findings, what their x-ray studies were. You can go and save money, and you can be much more effective in the care. So improving the clinical care of patients is the first priority for these health information exchanges. But can you imagine the kind of data that's flowing through these exchanges for public health surveillance and other kinds of purposes? Huge. It's almost unthinkable. So what we did is we developed a contest. This is the Maryland Prize. It was funded by a private foundation. It was open to the country, across the country, and it was a contest to come up with some of the most innovative ways for public health purposes to take an information exchange and to apply it to see how there could be secondary benefits, secondary to clinical treatment. So this is the website of the contest. I'm sorry, the contest is now closed. It closed at the end of April. We got, almost 100 really well-developed proposals. It was almost like somebody had a proposal and we were waiting to put a contest out there. I'll tell you, the winning proposal was a $5,000 award, and what this researcher did was pretty straightforward. She was an individual who worked with the data in one of Maryland's got two poison centers. So poison, people call poison. I used to think people called poison centers because the toddler had picked up some soap under the kitchen, and of course that happens, under the sink. But more and more, people are calling poison centers to understand what their friend, their loved one has just ingested, what maybe they themselves have just ingested. I'm feeling funny. I took this med. I kind of don't think it's right. And so to look for clinical advice, oftentimes, astoundingly often, as a result of prescription drug abuse. And so this data, this researcher said, I got all this poison control data. Every day I got logs of people that call me. How about if I marry that with the data that comes into the public health department from the medical examiner? So in Maryland, all of the medical examiner, I don't know, maybe you've got coroners, we've got medical examiners, it all rolls up to the state. And so when we have a death, when we have a drug overdose death, we've got all the toxicology, we've got all the forensic investigation, we've got all the reports about those deaths. But that's not complete. The poison center has got all the near misses, because anytime there's an emergency room admission with any kind of toxicology suspect, the emergency room calls the poison center. So I'll just give you an example of how the marriage of these two data sets was just phenomenal, set off all kinds of light bulbs. And so there were runners up and a lot of enthusiasm about that contest. So that's an example of how we could kind of think really creatively about technology. I want to show you another example. What this is a screenshot of the website. As those ideas were coming up, they were crowdsourced. They were validated on an open website. So it wasn't just some people at the health department got all the ideas and then we went in the back room and decided who the winners were. The crowd themselves, and many of you have seen this, voted up, down, and then validated some of the ideas as they moved through a review process. So this is a screenshot of how it works. A lot of people put their real Facebook pictures up there. I guess on this one they didn't, but on how the actual technology worked for this Maryland Prize. We took this technology from a very small foundation grant, and we applied it to our own workforce. So bringing it back home to what we can do for our workforce, cheap. This is really, really cheap. You put up one of these tools. It's an interactive tool that elicits ideas from the workforce, from every level, so it's non-hierarchical. Anybody can put up a good idea. People vote those ideas, and we have a small amount of money that we're going to implement the winning idea. The small amount of money, again, came from a foundation. So the idea is, how can we tap into the creative ideas of the people, and there are still some people on the workforce left. How can we tap into those ideas and really capture all that good work? The last thing I want to leave you with, again, one more slide. I know you can't see this, but we see the role of public health at the state level is a convener of good ideas. So you saw that with these idea contests, but also with employee wellness. This is a really special website that is the convener of the innovation that's going on around the state as far as the clinical innovation. Maybe it's patient-centered medical homes, maybe it's care transitions, the warm handoff for individuals, how to integrate the clinical improvements with the financing improvements. So not to get, so there's, we've got bundled care, we've got financing improvements that will reduce, drive down readmissions. There's a lot of creative, and we want to look at those creative financing along with the clinical innovations. And so what you see there is a description of integrated programs that both marry the clinical and financial improvements. And these are specific programs at a certain clinic. This is what's happening. And an opportunity to check in and to look at the evaluation of what the impact has been on the health department, the local health department itself, as well as with the clients. So I close now just by saying that these are some ideas as far as leveraging the relationships that you all have, as far as looking for win-win opportunities in financial mechanisms out there, as well as marshaling technology to do the great work that you do. So thank you. Happy to take your questions.
Okay, we now have time for questions for our panelists, comments, or other good ideas. You with yes.
Thank you all, because I think that there are a lot of stories in the field of public health about some windows of bright lights, you know, bright lights that are happening in a very tough time, and your story at King County and Maryland are just wonderful. Thank you very much. I'm Carol Woltring. I've been very involved in leadership development, and the leadership element is coming through in a lot of different places as we talk about change. And I really appreciate that. I started up a new consulting group called the Health Leadership Policy and Systems Group. I have a comment about the concept of public health reset. I really like an ability to hang on to some framing as we not necessarily muddle through, but I think we are a little bit muddling through the things that can be done. And I think that the idea of a reset or something like that, it resonates with me. And Gina, I wanted you to, I'm going to read the book, but I wanted you to comment, and maybe the other speakers comment on, are there some kind of paradigms that could help us? Because we're doing a lot of things to help reset public health. Quality improvement is a reset. Technology has reset technology. Solving complex problems requires a reset in terms of the shift to health equity and place-based work. So I really like it, and I'm stimulated by it. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. I mean, some of the things we can do is look back. Again, I go back to rebuilding our political skill set. If we're gonna have impact on this reset. And again, it's going to be a political discussion. It cannot occur until this current intractable talk, conflict of the political left and the political right just screaming past each other. That we have to get past that. When that occurs, I'm not sure. But we can look historically inside our own cultural DNA of where the successes have been. Okay. I mean, in my childhood career, you know, I was in the room when the first 4-H cases were reported to CDC Director Staff. Now, that looked grim for a long time, both scientifically and then the social, political, you know, those cultural wars were crazy. But it moved quicker than we ever thought. And all of a sudden, we had the Americans with Disabilities Act, with probably the most egalitarian piece of legislation since the Civil Rights Act. And other countries followed that you shall not discriminate against people on the basis of a disability. So it changes quick. But clearly, those AIDS warriors knew all about political skill sets. You know, Larry Kramer and Jeff Levy and all of those legends. I mean, I was on the other side. I was receiving the blows from them, from CDC on them. So they're experts. Look at the tobacco wars. We're gearing up for another war against big food and sugar-sweetened beverages. Okay? You see that. Right? You read it in the paper. You see the blogs. Well, we've got leadership living. You're California people, okay? We're the warriors in eventually learning how to fight a well-financed, well-politically connected opponent and bring them to ground, okay? So we need to bring into our tent the warriors that have had success. There are political lessons learned in tobacco wars or in AIDS wars or in some of the occupational health. But it's going to take some leadership as well. People have to step up and lead this. I mean, I'm just fortunate that I'm in a place where I can speak out and say what I think ought to be said. But there are plenty of skilled people who have seen these kind of wars occur who can help us with getting ourselves ready for this reset. So part of it is patience, and part of it is impatience. Anybody want a piece of that?
Either friend?
I don't want a piece of that. No, thank you. I totally agree. The reset, I think that in part what Gene was talking about, the reset, that we're not public health doing the one-off, that we're looking at very broad policy change and environmental change, and that's what tobacco was about.